It's time for the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought was possible. With your own personal pilgrim on the 405, here's Mr. Will Crist.
Well, sometimes being the pilgrim on the 405 means being open to serendipity. And a couple of weeks ago, I got an email through LinkedIn, of all things, saying, you know, you really ought to talk to this guy. This guy has got some very good things to talk about. And this guy happens to be David Pinsak, who wrote a book called Innovation for Underdogs. And this friend of mine said, you really ought to talk to David. And by the way, why don't you take a look at his book? So on my way to the villages in Alaska up on the Arctic Circle, I took a look at David's book. I kindled it, I downloaded it, read it up there, and it's fascinating. Never knew that there was a system for innovation that one could use. I thought innovation maybe was, you know, gift of the gods, or maybe the right things coming together at the right time, having to be there for them, and then it becomes entrepreneurship. But having read David's book and now having spoken with David, I can see that there's some things that we can do not only to help young people but also to help adults, 50, 60, 70-year-olds, innovate. And perhaps, just perhaps, we may be in touch with that thing which makes America, America, that innovative drive that's different from any other country in the world, any other culture in the world, that innovation that we're going to get David to tell us about. Now, some of the interesting things about David, he was, an undergraduate at Princeton University, went to Harvard for graduate school, spent 30 years at DuPont. But one of the very interesting things is he sat on Einstein's lap. So I want to welcome a new good friend all the way from Delaware, David Pinsak. So, David, welcome to Pilgrim on the 405.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And I know the area that you are calling from because my wife used to live there and speaks very, very highly of Laguna Beach and Dana Point and all that.
So how long ago was it that she was here?
I'm sorry, can you speak up? I'm having trouble hearing you.
About how long ago was it that she was here?
Well, I'm going to have to pick up another handset because I can barely hear you at all. Hold on just a moment, please.
The joys of live radio, right, Will?
Right.
Okay, is that better?
I said this is the joys of live radio. We can hear you fine, so it's
okay.
A question if you
can
hear us.
I can hear you fine now.
Okay. So how long ago was she in Dana Point?
Well, phone just wigged out on me again. Okay. You said something about Dana Point?
How long ago was it that she was living in Dana Point?
Up until 5 years ago. And must have been a meteorite or something hitting her, and she decided that living in Delaware was preferable to living in Southern California.
Well, there's only one difference between here and Delaware that I think that she might have something to think about. That's going to be David Pinsak.
You keep fading in and out. I'm having terrible trouble hearing you.
Shall we try and call you back on another?
Now I can hear you great.
Well, I'm on a different. You can probably hear me because I'm in a studio and I come through louder here. Will's on Skype, and I can hear him fine. It all sounds good going over the air here, but maybe it's not loud enough for you here. I'm gonna let Will say something again here, and let's see if we can tune this in.
Okay.
All right. So what I was wondering is, tell us that the difference between Dana Point and Delaware. The only difference there is David Pinsak, and that's why she moved.
Yes, she is that much of a masochist.
All right, so tell us about innovation. Tell us about your book. What did you do at DuPont?
Well, I spent 30 years at DuPont, and I really, really liked the people and the chance to do all kinds of neat science. Because DuPont at the time was probably the most diversified technology company in the world in terms of the number of industries they were in, the number of countries. So if you like problem solving, that was a great place. The CEO at the time, when he recruited me, said, you have two choices. You can be a big fish in a small pond, or a small fish in a big pond, or maybe you can be a big fish in a big pond. Do you have the guts to try?
Mm-hmm.
So I tried and got into all kinds of mischief in my 30 years there. I really, really feel that was so helpful in stretching my brain and making me think.
Well, tell us some of the things that you were involved in. What's some of the projects that you can tell us without killing us?
Well, they range from very low-tech. I developed a system for processing animal manure. Because whether we like it or not, animals produce a lot of waste. If you took all of the cows in Wisconsin and you had them working together to fill the University of Wisconsin football stadium to overflowing, and it seats 100,000 people, it would take them about 18 hours.
18 hours?
So that's just a huge problem. So I developed some whole new ways of processing the manure by changing the chemistry of it and mixing it with things that you would even find in a grocery store, because I found if you add cellulose, sugar, and some untrained air, it decomposed totally differently. So we mixed things like Rice Krispies and marshmallow fluff with the manure, and it was an amazing change. Corn flakes didn't work very well. So that was one end of the spectrum. The other end was theoretical chemistry, where we were trying to figure out how to make molecules behave differently, because Mother Nature does things her way unless we find a way to talk to her gently.
Uh-huh. So any particular projects?
Well, the one that was the most fun for me, we were trying to find a way to stabilize concrete. Because whether we like it or not, we've got a whole bunch of concrete in the world, and it doesn't hold up very well to weathering. As soon as a little bit of water gets in, the water will freeze and expand and crack the concrete. And it was discovered about probably 50 or 60 years ago that if you mix a small amount of air with the concrete, you're providing little zones for expansion and contraction. But that also makes it easier for the water and the air to get into the reinforcing bar, which is why you see so much concrete rusting now. Well, we found a way to take old car tires, freeze them at liquid nitrogen temperatures, grind them up into a powder, and mix that with the concrete instead of the air. So we had the same expansion and contraction, but no way for air and water to get in. And it made just an enormous difference. Some of the test concrete samples were having 2 to 3 times the life cycle before they began to show weathering as traditional concretes.
So this was all, would this be all R&D at DuPont?
And that part was R&D, but there was still a lot of D, because the three biggest lies in the world are the checks in the mail, I'll still respect you in the morning, and I'm here from corporate R&D to help you. The folks in the plant sites, they really didn't want to have anything to do with us because, well, basically that exact reason. And so sometimes you had to roll up your sleeves and act like a customer and then try to figure out, what does the customer want? It's very easy when you're sitting back in R&D headquarters to say, well, I can make this. But asking, does the customer want it? I'll just give you a very straightforward example. In my teaching, one of the questions I ask my students is, how would you speed up the game of golf? And they very quickly say, well, you've got to eliminate the time that's spent hunting for lost golf balls. But if your golf is so bad that you lose balls, it is a social event for you, not a competitive sport. So you're actually happy to have the time to chat with the rest of your foursome. The golf ball manufacturers don't want you to find the balls, because if you lose them, you got to buy more. And the country clubs are very happy that you're playing slowly. It's less wear and tear on the course, but you still pay the same amount. And I gave that same question to my son when he was about 7 years old, because it was clear this was really wasn't a problem. We on the outside thought it was a problem, but the people who played golf didn't think it was. Well, he thought for no more than 30 or 40 seconds, and he says, well, Daddy, that's really simple. Girl dogs smell different than boy dogs. So if you take whatever it is that makes a girl dog smell the way she does spray that on the golf ball. Then when you go out to play, bring a boy dog with you because his nose is 1,000 times more sensitive than yours. He'll find the ball by smell. So here at age 7, he had a much more imaginative solution than any of us old gray-haired PhDs. And where this plays out is the whole question which you were alluding to, and that is, can innovation be taught? Are we intrinsically innovative or what? And I thought about saying, well, let me tell you the secret of innovation. But there is no secret. It's we're all pre-wired for it. Because really only two choices. If you look at our genealogy at the DNA level, we all evolved from the same group of people in Africa about 50, 60,000 years ago. And yet, over that period of time, we as humans have come up with millions of significant innovations. And so either we are intrinsically innovative, or little green men from Mars came down and did all that for us. And since no culture's mythology even mentions little green men from Mars, that's prima facie evidence that we are intrinsically innovative.
Well, let's not forget Area 51 now, right, David?
I wouldn't dream of forgetting about Area 51 unless it forgets about me first. But if you listen to Noam Chomsky, he argues that we're pre-wired for language. And I've disagreed vigorously with him and his disciples. We're pre-wired for innovation, and language is just an innovation which we had to develop to meet our needs for procreation, food, safety, and the like. And the only reason we were able to develop language is we had the brain capacity to do it, and our larynx is far enough away from where we're eating that we can make a separate set of noises that another of our species would not get confused with just eating noise.
Okay.
But if you look at humans versus other animals, there are many changes. So teaching is just an absolute vital part of what we do, and we need to do more of it. So I'm personally very unhappy with the school systems these days, because in their drive to have the standardized tests, they're often telling students, your answer is wrong, when it is a correct answer, but it's not the one that they're looking for. And where this plays out is you can stifle innovation very easily. The minute you tell somebody they're wrong or that idea isn't worth anything, it's a whole lot less likely they'll ever come up with another idea again. At least one that they'll tell you. The issue is that we've created a society where there are perceived to be just two outcomes. You succeed or you fail. But in fact, there's a third outcome. You did everything very well, but some force that you have no control over or no knowledge of prevented you from getting across the finish line. But that should be rewarded every bit as enthusiastically as if you were a stunning success rather than punished as failure, which is what they do now.
Well, tell us, what is innovation?
Okay. Humans are capable of doing four things. Now, I'm sure that there's some congressmen who might disagree with that. But the first is rote repetition. The second is accidental discovery. The third is innovation, and the fourth is invention. There's no question what rote repetition is. Accidental discovery is stumbling on something. As an illustration, about 8,000 years ago, there were some very early hominids in eastern China who were eating fruit that had fallen from a tree and started to ferment. And they got a real buzz on from doing that, because there was alcohol in it. And from that, the whole brewing industry evolved. That's accidental discovery. Innovation is identifying a problem. It doesn't have to be a new problem. And trying to figure out what to do about it. If you consider the world to be a jigsaw puzzle, every year you pick up a few new pieces and you remember them to the best of your ability. And unless you get Alzheimer's or something like that, your ability to put the pieces together to solve problems improves. And unfortunately, our social structure, especially our business structure now, is saying, whoa, once you get past 50, you're over the hill, and you don't have anything that you can say that's of value to growing our country. And invention is just going one step further, as you lost a piece. By looking at the pieces around it, you try to figure out what the missing piece would have to look like. So innovation comes from three sources: a need, a dissatisfaction, or curiosity. Unless you're a teenager, and then want and need get sort of smushed together. But need is what you must have to survive. Dissatisfaction is, oh, that's pretty cool, but I think we can do it better. And curiosity is, how did nature do that? So I'd like to give you an example of innovation in a very business-like setting. A good friend of mine is a commercial real estate developer, and he leveraged himself to the hilt and bought this really big, expensive office building. And within a week, his largest tenant, who had more than half the floor space, says, I'm at the end of my rope. Your elevators have got to be the slowest ones on the planet. And you either replace these elevators or we're not going to renew our lease. Well, replacing the elevators would have cost him about $3 million, which he didn't have. And they wouldn't have been able to get any more money for it, so it was really a wrong thing for him to do. But he couldn't afford to lose his tenant either. So we opened a bottle of good California Cabernet that night, and we realized that the problem is not really the speed of the elevators. It's that we were giving the tenants in the building nothing else to do while waiting for the elevator. So that weekend, we brought in a crew, and we took down all the wallpaper on the elevator lobbies and replaced them with floor-to-ceiling mirrors. So now we're waiting for the elevator. You can check to see if your tie is right, if your hem is straight. Within a week, he started to receive letters of commendation from his tenants. Like, you are a miracle worker. You've only had the building less than a month. You replaced the elevators. We didn't see any noise, disruption, nothing. You just did a fabulous job. So then he turns around and increases the rent, and they're happy, because he got to the root cause of what is the dissatisfaction about. You don't want to listen to what they say. You want to figure out what it really is. One of the things that we're taught in the business schools, for example, is when you've identified a problem, you figure out a solution, you turn around and you work backwards from where you are to now to how you would have to get there. That presupposes that the first idea you come up with will always be the best. Now, maybe I'm not as smart as the MBA students, but I've never had my first idea being the best one. What my methodology teaches is how to take the initial concept of a problem, generalize it, make it more specific, back and forth, until you have a pretty good handle on where the problem really is. You still don't jump to a solution at that point. You make a list of what any acceptable solution would have to have. Then and only then you go out and look for something that meets those characteristics that may also work for a lot of other things you hadn't thought about. So I guess I try to teach, don't jump too soon. Another thing that I teach fairly dogmatically is based on the movie The Wizard of Oz. When the lion, the tin man, and the straw man are trying to help Dorothy get to the Emerald City, they're lamenting that they don't have a heart, they don't have a brain, they don't have courage. And yet, while they're helping Dorothy get there, they show they do. Well, the wizard has been watching all this, and when they get to the city, he gives each of them a placebo and says, now you have a heart, now you have a brain. All he's done is given them permission to exhibit the skills that they already have. And that is what the American business world does not do a very good job of. Our people are much more intelligent, much more perceptive than we let them think they are.
What would we need to do to change that?
Excuse should be. Well, there's a couple of things. First, we've got to stop governing by fear. And far too many companies in the current economic climate, if you innovate, somebody's going to lose their job over it. It's you or your carpool or your best buddy or something. So you really don't have an incentive to do it. People, by and large, don't like change. We don't reward people very well for innovations. Look at the number of companies who provide cash bonuses when their employees do something good. You'd think on the surface that would be really great, but it turns out to backfire horribly. Let's say there were four people on a project. One of them got a $5,000 bonus, and the others each got $2,500. Well, the guys who got $2,500 are going to say, whoa, I did every bit as much, maybe more than he did. Why does he get twice as much money as I do? So instead of the bonus building more cohesiveness in the team, it's spreading it apart. You tend to be much more protective of your information. Secondly, if you give cash, it almost always goes to pay a bill right then and there. So out of sight, out of mind, you have no long-term benefits of having gotten that bonus. And so what I've started to do in the companies that I've founded and the ones that I consult for is recognize the most important thing to a human is food. If I think somebody's done well, I have a national account with Domino's Pizza, and I get three large pizzas with everything on it delivered to their office precisely at 10 o'clock in the morning, because that's when your blood sugar is lowest. A good pizza has got a wonderful aroma. You don't have to brag to your compatriots that you got a bonus. They can smell it, and they'll begin to salivate. You can't eat three large pizzas by yourself. Even my teenage son is incapable of that most times. You can't leave the pizza waiting until you get home to give it to your family, because then you're going to have three large discs of congealed grease. So what do? You stick your head out in the hall, you say, pizza time, and everybody comes running. You're sharing the most fundamental craving that humans have, and that's food, with your associates. Even if the guy next door has been on an entirely different project, he will be appreciative of the fact that you've given him food. So if he gets some food, he's going to invite you. And you get communications taking place that a normal corporate hierarchy would never have happened. And I can't stress too strongly the importance of this unexpected conversation. So I'll just give you one example. I was at a meeting in Washington, and I wound up sitting next to a guy who'd been very senior in the executive corps' medical staff. And he told me that in several of the airplanes used for transporting executives like the president, they put in refrigerators now so they can carry several units of typed and cross-matched blood for whoever is on the plane. The problem is, when the plane lands, they don't want to expose the blood to ambient temperatures, so they leave the blood on the plane, and they have a car and driver who will go deliver the blood if it's needed. And I almost screamed at the guy, if he needs blood, he needs it now, not an hour and a half from now by the time you've driven it to him. So his doctor pushes back, and he said, we got to keep the blood cold, and we are not going to be walking behind the vice president or the secretary of defense carrying a styrofoam cooler with his shield on it and advertising to the world that we've got his blood in there. So I went home and I bought an old attaché case at Goodwill, lined it with some insulation, some phase change material to keep it constant, put in a couple of IV bags that would normally have blood in them, but I don't keep blood around the house because I'm not a vampire, despite what my neighbors may say. And I was able to keep the stuff at plus or minus half a degree centigrade for 12 hours with no additional input of energy. So now if you watch some of our senior executives as they're traveling, you'll see somebody not too far from them carrying a ratty old attaché case that's got their blood in it. So if anything happens, their blood's right then and there. Would this have ever happened if I hadn't been lucky enough to sit next to this guy at a meeting? No. Part of the whole chain of innovation is exposing people to problems they may not have even known existed. Everybody knows things, and are the things appropriate to the problems that are being tasked with doing? Not always. But look at all the people who've been laid off from the auto manufacturers. They've got an immense range of skills. I encountered this firsthand about a month or two ago because I was having a metalworking problem, and I tried everything that I could think of. There's no way that in a normal basement shop you can weld a 1/16 of an inch thick aluminum and make a nice rigid right angle bend in it. I was at the dog park with one of my dogs, playing with one of his dogs, happened to tell him about the problem. And he said, oh, no sweat. After we're done, come over to my house. I'll show you how to do it. It turns out it was incredibly simple. It was something that they had developed when they were doing some very secret stuff for the government. But the project wasn't even ongoing anymore. I said, is this something I could have been expected to know or find by Googling it? He said, you damn well better not have been able to find it. This used to be top secret. It isn't anymore, but we have no way of taking all the things that you as a taxpayer had paid for the development of and even telling you we've got them. So 5 minutes with this guy in his basement solved a problem that had been gnawing at me for nigh onto a year, and I was tearing my hair out by the clump. Where this impacts us in the question that you started off with, the Kauffman Foundation is a philanthropic organization out of the Midwest that really espouses innovation. And in February this year, they gave a presentation on the State of the Union for Innovation Entrepreneurship. They had two representatives from the government there, the governor of Nebraska and the governor of Delaware. The governor of Nebraska said, it's critical we get the country to realize innovation is not just for 20-somethings, but it's for 30-somethings and sometimes 40-somethings. I wanted to jump for his throat and say, what about 50-somethings, 60-somethings, 70-somethings? We're not brain dead just because our hair has turned gray. And so I've been laying out now for the National Governors Conference a whole suite of programs to take the people who've got the skills and the experience that made the U.S. competitive and transfer it to younger generations. And this is an imperative. If we don't do it, given that more than half the graduate students in the United States now in the technical fields are foreign nationals, who when they learn stuff, get their degree, they go home, they're not there to help the U.S. They're there to compete with us. If we can't capture the wisdom of the old codgers, we have no way of being competitive on a worldwide basis anymore.
All right, David, so can you stick around after this break, this ad, we're going to hear from our sponsors. Can you stick around and let's talk about what we might be able to do concretely?
I would be happy to do so.
Do you recognize them in your office? It's a common problem for executives and employees everywhere. There's John, over there. He just seems to have his own vision. Unfortunately for you, it's not your company's vision. Then there's Mary, who always seems to fall short of what's expected. You've got people that need to turn it up a notch if you're ever going to hit your goals. The never-ending cost of losing people and having to train the rookies. You constantly worry about losing key people you have become too dependent on. Extended Disc is designed for business owners, executives, and employees just like you. Extended Disc provides you with information to make better business decisions with confidence. Extended Disc helps you and your organization to be more profitable by avoiding decisions that result in expensive mistakes, wasted resources, and time. You see the problem. Extended Disc, the solutions you need to push performance and growth. It's time you made a call to Extended Disc for the solutions you need. Extended Disc, toll free, 1-800-257-7481, or go to www.extendeddisc.com.
And now back to Will and his guest.
All right, so David, what is it that we could do? Let's take the next 20 minutes and just talk about what we could do here in Southern California to help encourage innovation, help business to create more jobs. What is it that we need to, that you think we could do to strengthen the country and move forward?
Well, the first thing is we've got to find a way to help people continue to keep their education. current. I like to describe a college education as similar to the Hubble Space Telescope, where after 4 years you think you know everything, they launch you and all of a sudden, whoa, things are out of focus. They aren't quite what I thought they were. We have to legitimize programs where that people of any age can go back and learn new skills, be kept up to date. A critical piece of that is just getting access to information. Almost all the journals are available in electronic form right now. If you're a private citizen, you can't get access to them. You can buy individual articles at $35 to $50 a piece, but if you work for a company that's got access, you can get everything free as part of the subscription price. So if we want the people who are sitting home with these skills to come up with neat new ideas, then we're tying our hands behind their back and we're not letting them get the information to see if their ideas hold water. I'm very fortunate to live in Delaware, where they have a lifelong learning program through the university. And anybody over the age of 50 can take courses there, and it includes unlimited library access. I don't know how they had the vision and the wisdom to do that, but that's one of the reasons that Delaware is so successful in taking people of all ages and launching new ventures. So information access is a critical piece. Another is decent advice and counsel. You have lots of places which have incubators or accelerators, and those are great if you've already launched your business. But if you haven't launched it and you don't even know which way to turn, there's no place to go for help. The SBA doesn't help you with that. You're at a loss. Think of it in the context of the Olympic event of the broad jump. Up until 1912, it was a standing broad jump. The world record was about 3 meters. Then they changed it to the running broad jump, and now the world record is over 10 meters, three times longer. The difference is you've built up momentum, and you know what didn't work by watching other competitors. So the next step is you have to find a way to celebrate failure. I learn more by what doesn't work than what does. Whether it's you have a community center where I call it Failure Anonymous, something like that, analogous to Alcoholics Anonymous, when you send them to, I'm an alcoholic, and say, I tried this and it failed. Everybody says, good for you. That was really neat that you tried. And then you discuss what are the lessons in why it failed. And under the auspices of the governor of Delaware, I've set up a task force right now where we're taking only people who've tried something and failed at it, because they know more about what to avoid, what a landmine looks like, than everybody sitting there all smiling, being bobbleheads. So that's the second step. Third is we have to find a way that these people who are sitting home counting clouds or just playing golf and can be integrated back into local companies and schools and universities. Think about the number of professors in the University of California system who have been getting clobbered by the cutbacks in state funding. I mean, it's catastrophic. My oldest daughter went to Cal State Long Beach. She couldn't even graduate on time because they didn't offer the courses that she needed to complete her degree that year. So we wound up sending her for 5 years. Well, you've got all these people who'd love to have the chance to come back and work in the lab or help a professor with teaching. We don't have a mechanism whereby they can do that. Now think of it in the context of younger kids. If you have, let's just say, a middle school child, the only adults they have ever dealt with are their parents or their teachers or some other authority figure. They don't have any clue that an adult has a brain. An adult has a Klingon pain stick, but that's it. And now if you take people who are in their 20s, they have no experience with youngsters except their own siblings, who they probably didn't like very much. And so what I've been doing with many of the middle schools around here is having their students come meet with mid-career professionals, executives, and even retired folks, and watching the conversations between them, because kids think they're immortal. They're not afraid. There's nothing they don't think they can do. So watching the dialogue between them, everybody winds up winning. To it, there's a course I teach, and usually about halfway through, I'll ask one of the students in the class to talk about an innovation which he or she tried in his company. And then what happened? And then after about 5 minutes of that, I turn the classroom into a courtroom and say, you were charged with subversive innovation. You took company time and company resources to work on something that you thought was interesting and valuable with no approval from anybody in your line management, and you weren't doing what we were paying you to do. And then I pick other students in the class to be CEO, HR manager, jury, judge, all that. And this just absolutely captures their imagination. The last time I did this, which was about 3 weeks ago, it was a big multinational firm which had prided itself on being extremely innovative. And instead of the exercise going for about 40 minutes, it was still going hot and heavy after 4 hours. Everybody was getting hungry and grouchy at that point. So we called a halt to it. But the CEO and the COO of the company had been sitting in the back corner unnoticed by the attendees. They came up to me afterwards and said, we have just learned more in the last 4 hours about what makes an innovator tick than we have in the previous 25 years. Because the structure you set up is removing the hierarchy of communication. Everybody could say what they believed without worrying, is their job in jeopardy for saying it? The CEO said, there was so much more openness, because people were willing to say what they believed the executive management of the firm should know. So that's another piece. A third is you can't do what most companies do, which is say, I'm going to bring the most innovative people together into a room, and you work with them. I insist on half of any group being people who are not seen as innovative by their peers. Case in point, I got a hold of a bunch of photographs that De Beers had used to evaluate some new advertising model for diamonds. And we analyzed this in class, and in their assignment, these were MBA and DBA students, but had full-time jobs during the day, was to come up with an advertising campaign for coal. They come back the following week, and there's this woman, probably mid-40s, had been quiet as a church mouse throughout the entire course, but she brought in a tray which she'd covered with velvet, had a lump of coal sitting right in the middle of it, and a little sign that said, screw the Arabs, shift to coal. Well, suddenly she blossomed in the class and became an active participant. But the most important thing is the other folks in the class who didn't believe that they could be innovative said, if she can do it, I can do it. So you need to have motivators within the class or organization who are perceived as not being innovative. And if you can turn them, you turn the whole organization.
All right. So, David, what could we do in Southern California that could get innovation, you know, how could we get some innovation going here? Not that we don't. We have lots of innovation. But what could we do to strengthen that, to encourage it more? Let's get very concrete.
Okay. First, you have to figure out what an innovator wants. And by and large, an innovator's not doing it for money. They're doing it for legacy or for pride or something like that. You have to figure out a way to reward them for the behavior that you want. I was having a discussion just today with the Defense Department on precisely the question you asked. And I said, don't throw money at the innovators. Have a picnic out in the courtyard of the Pentagon. Bring some significant people in, like the Secretary of Defense, and bring a couple of innovators in. Just stir it up and see what happens. And what you pay the people who come to do this with is photographs. When I was starting my latest consulting business, I was fortunate enough to have a photograph of me right across the table from, at that point, Senator Biden, now Vice President Biden. People walked into my office and I said, "You know Biden?" It wasn't just a standing, stiff shaking of hands. This was we were really talking about something. And so just being legitimized by a photograph of a coherent, mutually beneficial conversation with people whose word means something to the general public will be more valuable than just money. So that's step number one. And step number two is find a way to make patents affordable. Right now, when the people came out with provisional patents, outfits like the Nolo Press published a book, said, write the patent yourself for $100. That has been catastrophically damaging, because when people write their own patents, they don't really have any significance or legal weight. So they will assume that when they go out and try to shop their idea and get validation of it, they're protected, when in fact they're not. They're giving away all of their intellectual property. So I would have municipalities and the states somehow incent law firms or retired patent attorneys to, for a very reasonable price, help draft provisional patents for innovators. If you pay a traditional patent attorney's rates to do it, you're talking probably $10,000 to $15,000. And some folks will have 6, 8, 10 ideas in a year. How many innovators could afford that amount of money? And very, very few. But if they could get access to somebody who will help them produce, a patent is good enough to begin to get the feedback from the world on what they come up with. They'll get so excited, they'll put in 60 hours a week that they'd never do if they'd had to risk $10,000 or $15,000 of their own money. They'd be far too cautious. So that's the next thing I'd do.
Uh-huh.
And the third would be, if somebody comes up with a good idea, give them publicity. Publicity doesn't hurt and doesn't cost much. And if somebody gets a great idea, a great invention, invite them to give a lecture at the public library or at City Hall or something like that. By and large, innovators thrive on people saying, "Hey, that's neat." There's an organization I've heard about. I haven't tracked them down to see whether it's apocryphal. But if you think about the times that you hear of somebody else's idea, you slap yourself in the forehead and you say, "Well, why didn't I think of that?" And this outfit claims they're called the Fractured Forehead Company. That they try to convince people to just look at other folks' ideas and hit themselves at, "Why didn't I think of it?" So that would be the third thing. Encourage people to try and fail and celebrate the fact that they tried.
Well, what if we brought you out here to Southern California for a couple of days or even a week? What do you think would be interesting, helpful, innovative, supportive of innovation? What would be helpful?
Well, I would first like to convince people that there are ways to be innovative and have fun and make money that has nothing to do with the Internet. And we've gotten into this mystique right now that only the really high-tech websites are where you can make any money. Or maybe you can go do hardware and create the next iPad, but you got to have 10,000 people working for you to do it. So I would start by getting them to realize there are many, many, many places that you can be innovative that will make a difference. One of my favorites is the fact that my wife is addicted to coffee. If she could walk up and down the halls with an IV stand behind her dripping coffee into her veins, she'd be thrilled by it. But when she gets in the car, and the same is true with my daughters, they're always carrying their travel mug, and they're complaining that the coffee doesn't taste very good. Turns out the answer was really simple, and the lid that's keeping it from spilling on you is keeping the aroma from getting to your nose. So it's like drinking coffee when you have a bad cold with a clothespin on your nose. So once you see that, then it became an absolute piece of cake. I designed a new kind of membrane, which was from small scraps of Gore-Tex. I drilled some holes on the top of a travel mug, and I founded a company on it. My total investment into where I had something that could demonstrate the concept cost me $7. You've got to get people to understand you don't have to have a PhD, you don't have to have a ton of money to be innovative. They're still afraid of it. Another thing that works very well, are you familiar with the concept of speed dating?
Yes.
Well, what I espouse is speed innovating. I give each person a 3x5 card with something on it, and then everybody else in the room, they get to talk to them for 1 minute. And after you've talked to everybody, then you pair off as to who you're going to go work on the problem more concertedly with. The longer you spend thinking about and trying to analyze a problem, the more conservative you get, and the more reluctant you will be to actually do something. So I take a bunch of people who've got a brain, got some interest, and I'd run them through speed dating and then chronicle what are the neat things they've come up with. And they will probably say, I didn't even realize that.
Well, if we had a group of people who are running accelerators or incubators, and they wanted to prime the pump, what kind of program would we be talking about? Would it be a day, a week, what, two or three times? What kind of program?
I would, from my experience, which may or may not be generally applicable, after a day, people begin to lose interest. Just because if you want to get something done, give it to somebody who's busy. Because if they're not already busy, there's some good reason why they're not. Anybody can give up a day to try to learn something new. Ask them to give up 2, 3, or 4 consecutive days. They'll smuggle their iPhone in and hide it under the desk and be checking their mail while they should be listening and then participating. So it could be just a one-day program or a Monday and a Friday or a Friday and then give them homework over the weekend. And the reason that I like to split it, think about a chess match where when you're about to adjourn, you have to write down what move you would do next if you weren't adjourning so that whoever's turn is doesn't have overnight to think of their move. What I found is if you do that, it takes you much less time when you come in the next day to pick up where you were when you left off. Just ballpark, the people I've measured this on, I'm going to find they're getting another hour a day because they walk in the morning, they open the envelope, and damn, yeah, that's all I was working on. Let's go from there. And so part of the concrete things are teaching little tricks and skills like that. I mentioned that innovation comes from a need, a dissatisfaction, or curiosity. Get people a bunch of 3x5 cards. Let them write down on those anything that strikes their fancy. And then periodically take the cards, shuffle them, and deal them out in pairs. So you'll see something that annoyed you a year ago juxtaposed against something that you found really interesting 3 days ago, but you've forgotten about both. Seeing them side by side totally changes your way of thinking. I'll give you an example from one of my courses. One day a student came in looking lower than the snake's belly in a wagon rut. It seems he'd gone to a big shopping mall the previous Saturday night with his girlfriend, been a long wait to get into the restaurant they wanted. While they're waiting, they both got low blood sugar, they got irritable, they got into a fight, and they broke up. But the student next to him was all excited because he finally learned about touchscreen technology. And he was convinced that touchscreen technology was the biggest advance in civilization. So I made the two students work together. I said, take both of your situations and come up with a profitable business. They both looked at me like I was smoking dope, but within about 30 minutes, they'd realized the issue at these shopping malls is how do you get on the waiting list for the restaurant without having to walk down to the restaurant? They put in a sample kiosk at one end of the mall and found that people love to put in the reservations, pick a time, but they continue to shop while doing. And then we upgraded it to where you could put a charge card reader on there, and you could pre-order your meal. So when your time comes up, you walk down there, your table's waiting, the food's on the table, you eat it, you get up and go, because the check's already been covered. The restaurant claimed to have gotten almost triple the number of turns of tables at no increased labor cost by using this.
And
so a very concrete thing to do is take people from various parts of a company and make them work together to find a commonality that they might not have ever even recognized before. The only thing they might have realized is they both park in the same parking lot.
Dave,
we are so brainwashed in how we think about things. If I asked you to name a car manufacturer that begins with F, you can do that in a heartbeat, and you'll say Ford. But if I said name a manufacturer that ends in I, you have to list all the car manufacturers you can think of and look at which ones end in I because you haven't stored it that way. But the process of insisting you do that will fundamentally change how you store succeeding information, which you learn work, at home, church, whatever.
Oh, that's wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been a very enjoyable conversation. And I'm going to take this interview and spread it around to a couple of incubator friends and see if they have any interest in bringing you out here for a couple of days.
I would be delighted and honored, and I'll close with just one anecdote to let you see why. I was recently reading the autobiographies of a number of Nobel laureates, and I was reading the one about Herbert Kroemer, who got the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2000, and discovered to my utter amazement his first job out of graduate school had been working for my father at RCA. And he remembered in his autobiography stuff my father had told him 50 years ago. So I called my mother and I said, do you remember Dad talking about Herb Kroemer? I said, yeah. He said, he was awfully bright, but unless he got his act together, he was never going to amount to much. So just knowing that what he had said to somebody 50 years ago had changed his life is fabulous. If I can impact one life in each session, I've earned my food and bread that day.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. David, tell us a little bit about if somebody wanted to talk to you, how could they get in touch with you? And tell us about, tell us the title of your book and where they can get it.
Well, the book is entitled Innovation for Underdogs. And the reason for the title is I'm a dog fanatic. I have 6 Bichon Frises, little white furry dogs. I was taking a nap on the kitchen couch one day. They all jumped up on top of me and fell asleep without waking me. My son took a photograph of this and said, now I understand what you do, Dad. It's innovation under dogs. My publisher loved it, so that's where the title came from. Amazon has it. Rye University in India bought 20,000 copies of it. The president gave it to everybody in the university, from the janitors all the way up. Said, by using what you see here, we have a chance of surpassing the U.S. and China both. I was really humbled and flattered, and then thrilled when he said, you don't have to autograph every copy.
Okay.
And
well,
the easiest
so
way to get me is pensack@comcast.net. I answer my own email. Okay. And anybody who wants to get in touch, I would be thrilled and happy to talk to them, because you never know who's going to have the next great idea that could change the world.
And it's davidpensack@comcast.net.
It's just pensack@comcast.net.
pensack@comcast.net. Wonderful. Thank you so much, David. We'll be talking with you soon.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it greatly. Good night.
Night. Well, there you have it. One of the best minds in the country, talking to us, inspiring us, encouraging us to be more innovative, and even giving us a system for being more innovative. I wouldn't be surprised if we see David out here sometime in the next quarter, next 6 months, spending a little time with us. And maybe there's some folks out there who would like to learn and be challenged to innovate. So there you have it. Another conversation with the Pilgrim wandering around on the 405. Now, if you haven't heard our shows and you want to hear them, they are available at octalkradio.net. octalkradio.net, and just look for the show Pilgrim Talks Pilgrim with the Pilgrim on the 405. So this is the Pilgrim on the 405. Looking forward to talking with you next week. So take care, have a great weekend, make it a great day tomorrow.
You've been listening to the one show that takes you where others won't, out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of what you thought was possible, with your own personal Pilgrim on the 405.